Today, we are 3 weeks removed from Resurrection Sunday, otherwise known in the pagan world as Easter. just my little shout out there. 3 weeks from today, we have four messages, and I was sharing with Corbett this morning that I really feel like this is the best lead-up we've ever had to our Easter Sunday service because, one, we're in the gospel, two, we're in the last week of Jesus' life, so today I'm going to read from you about the triumphal entry. Yes, that's called Palm Sunday. Yes, that normally happens in church the week before Easter. But there's so much that happens in between the triumphal entry and to the time of Christ's resurrection that we need these other 3 weeks in between or 2 weeks in between plus today to prep for it and for you to really see what's going on in that last week of Jesus' life. Next week, special guest speaker, former teaching pastor here that I and John worked with from 94 to 99, or at the end of 98, Dr. Paul Knoll will be here to speak on the Last Supper. So he's coming back down and visiting us. How many people here were in this church when Paul Knoll was teaching? A third. You want to get an idea how Tahoe turns over? How many people here were in this church when Rene Schlepfer, who now pastors a church of 4,000 in Aptos, was here? How many people were in this church when Bill Muir was the teaching pastor? Oh my gosh. My little babes. Wow. Wow, wow, wow. Tahoe does roll over, doesn't it? Okay. So today, we're talking about the triumphal entry. This is when Jesus, this is the last week, this is the beginning of the last week of his life before ultimately the Last Supper, his arrest, his suffering, his crucifixion, and then ultimately his resurrection. That all takes place in most of the Gospels. It's a third, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. It's approximately a third of the entirety of their story of Christ's life takes place in his last week. That's how significant it is. And so what we're going to look at today is literally Jesus, who we looked at a few weeks ago, set his face towards Jerusalem. He knew this day was coming. He knew this hour was coming upon his life. And now he's literally entering into Jerusalem for the Passover festival, the last time he will enter in to this city before he is killed. So I'd like to read this for you. You can follow along on the screen or in your notes. Luke chapter 19, starting with verse 28 through 40. After Jesus had said this, he went on ahead going up to Jerusalem. And I forgot what was in verse 27. Sorry, I would have warmed you up with that. Verse 29, as he approached these two little towns outside of Jerusalem, Bethpage and Bethany, at the hill called the Mount of Olives, he sent two of his disciples, saying to them, "Go to the village ahead of you, and as you enter it, you will find a colt tied there, which no one has ever ridden. Untie it, bring it here. If anyone asks you why you're untying it, tell him the Lord needs it." So those who were sent ahead, the two that were sent ahead, went and found it just as he had told them. And as they're untying the colt, sure enough, its owners asked them, "Why are you taking the colt?" And they replied, "The Lord needs it." They obviously were okay with that. And they brought it to Jesus. They threw their cloaks on the colt and put Jesus on it. And as he went along, people spread their cloaks on the road. This would be the red carpet treatment, right? Verse 37. When he came near the place where the road goes down the Mount of Olives, the whole crowd of disciples began joyfully to praise God in loud voices for all the miracles they had seen. And in verse 38, they cried out, "Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord. Peace in heaven and glory in the highest." Now some of the religious leaders, the Pharisees, the teachers of the law of Moses, in the crowd, said to Jesus, "Teacher," as he's going by and the crowd's yelling, "rebuke your disciples." We'll get to that in a moment. And Jesus responds, "I tell you, if they keep quiet, the stones will cry out." Now I want you to jump down to verse 45. What are we missing in between 40 and 45? This is where Jesus sits and looks over Jerusalem and weeps because he knows they are going to reject him. And this was their shot. But we're not covering that today, but I'll mention something later on about that. Verse 45, then he entered the temple area and he began driving out those who were selling. It is written, he said to them, my house will be a house of prayer, but you've made it a den of robbers. Verse 47, every day he was teaching at the temple, but the chief priests, the teachers of the law, and the leaders among the people were trying to kill him. Yet they could not find any way to do it because all the people hung on his words. All right, so we've been looking at the life of Christ as we see it in the Gospel of Luke. By way of reminder, interestingly enough, in the first 9 chapters of Luke, he addresses the question to his Gentile listeners who he's writing to. These are non-Jews, like most of us in this room. Who is this Jesus, this Jewish carpenter's son? And at the end of that 9 chapters, it culminated in this picture of who he is. Was when he's transfigured on the Mount of Transfiguration, right? He's glorified in front of Peter, John, and James. And they see with their own eyes the glorified Christ, which had to be just an amazing moment. But that was the culmination of who is this? Well, now we know who he is, right? Then in the second 9 chapters, Luke goes in, and in the middle chapters of his book, his gospel, he talks to us about what does it mean to follow him, to be, as it were, his disciple. And we looked at the things that there is a message that we're called to share of his life. We're talking about who then is our neighbor, the importance of prayer in the disciple's life, the importance of money and how it's to be treated, and generosity in the disciple's life, and forgiveness last week Noah preached on. These were all characteristics that were to be embraced by his followers, teachings about what it looks like to follow Jesus. Now, in these last 4 weeks leading up to Easter, we're going to look at the very last chapters of the Gospel of Luke. As I said earlier, the last week of his life. And that's why we just looked at this thing called the triumphal entry. And here's what I want us to note as we start. It's about the fact, what we're going to do in these last weeks, actually, if you want to subtitle that, I think it's in your notes, is we're literally going to experience him now. This existential moment in the gospel where we look at the life of Christ and it is so overwhelming and it is so powerful, a demonstration of the fulfillment of his life mission that you literally stand in awe and watch it unfold. And that's what I hope to bring you this morning. So what do we see right there in verse 38? Is the crowd shouting what? Blessed is the King. He's being declared the King, right? Remember when it was all said and done? Pilate puts above him on the cross the King of the Jews. He was incorrect. It should have said the King of the universe. But in this passage, I did an old journalistic trick, which is to give the who, what, why, and how of the storyline. We're going to look at what kind of king he is. So who is this king? Is point one. Who is he actually? He is the ultimate king, is what Luke is telling us here. Don't miss it, he says. And what do I mean by that? Well, in the very middle of the passage, when he's riding on this little colt, and we'll get to that in just a moment, these people throw their cloaks down, but greater than that is his disciples, the ones who say they follow him, begin to cry out in a loud voice, blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord. Peace in heaven and glory in the highest. They are, you and I don't know this unless we were to study it, but they are not quoting a phrase anew. This isn't a new song they're shouting out. They're pulling right out of the Old Testament scriptures, which is the only scriptures they had, the Jewish scriptures of the Old Testament, from Psalm 118, verse 26. And what Psalm 118, verse 26 is about is a messianic prophecy verse. In other words, it's written about the Messiah, the one that God was going to send to come. Because the Jews of Jesus' days, this was a very important theme in their stories, in their literature. And if you remember going back to the very beginning in Luke, We talked about what? When Jesus was born around Christmas, right? There was this high anticipation in the people that the Messiah was about to come. And that's why the birth story was so incredible. And that's why Herod went and killed all these babies, because he was afraid there was a king coming that was going to unsettle his throne. Remember that? So this theme was in their stories. It was in their literature. And their hope was this, that someday someone in the likeness of King David would return. Not the actual David. This was their messianic perspective. Now, they didn't believe in reincarnation. They didn't think literal David was coming back. But one unlike to David, who comes back and puts everything right. A triumphant Messiah, right? And that's why in Isaiah, written 7 centuries earlier, he prophesies, out of the stump of David's family will grow a shoot. Yes, a new branch. And notice how the translators capitalize the word branch. Because what are they talking about? They know we're talking about the ultimate king that's coming, bearing fruit from the old root, and the Spirit of the Lord will rest on him. So, where has this story come from? If you go back to the very beginning, which is Genesis means beginnings, in the 3rd chapter, at the very beginning of mankind's reign, Adam and Eve and God are over creation, and then everything falls apart. And we know that story. The serpent comes in a garden full of yeses, and he tempts them to look at the one no and to go, yeah, hey, what's going on here? Why is there a no? And then what happens in that is this great fall, right? And you can read in verse 15 of chapter 3 that the last thing that Adam and Eve hear from God face to face, and ultimately the last thing all of humanity would hear spoken from God without a mediator of some sort, a prophet or a revelation, right, is this word from God. In Genesis 3:15, the last thing he speaks. And it's this word of hope. Despite the darkness of that moment in the garden and all the suffering and death that would ensue in human history, God makes a great and grand declaration right there at the moment of the biggest screw-up that ultimately came upon mankind. And he says, I'm going to take on the serpent that has deceived you. I'm going to fight this dragon. And my offspring and his offspring are going to be enemies. And we will battle to the death. But I'm going to win, God says. It's like a WWE SmackDown talk, right? From now on, you and the woman will be enemies, he says to the serpent. And as your offspring and as will your offspring and hers. Meaning what? There's going to be a world full of people that still follow you, Satan. But there's going to be offspring of hers that are connected to me. And yes, you are going to strike the one I'm sending, his heel. But he will crush you. And he's foretelling right here in Genesis 3:15 the coming of the Messiah, the coming of his son. This is called the seed that runs all throughout the Old Testament. And God's telling us there's one who's coming in the future, and he's going to take on the forces of evil and death itself. And through him, though he will be wounded, he will crush sin and death. And what Luke is writing here in the triumphal entry is the fulfillment of this prophecy. Think about this. 4,000 years from that moment in the garden has transpired before Jesus' entry into Jerusalem that day, the coming king that will crush his head. And Luke is saying, this is the one of whom you seek, the ultimate king, the true king. And as John writes about this moment, the time, Jesus says, the time for judging this world has come, when Satan, the ruler of this world, will be cast out. This very ancient and very cosmic story is being played out on the human historical pages. Christ is literally coming into Jerusalem. Now, I want you to notice how quickly the religious leaders are freaked out by the crowd yelling, "Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord," because they too understood the context, right, of what these people were shouting out of Psalms, right? Blessed is this messianic king, the Davidic king that comes to set us free. And so in verse 39, they yell at Jesus, "Teacher, Rabbi, rebuke your disciples." And Jesus says, "I tell you, if they keep quiet, the stones will cry out." You know, he's trying to tell them, "Listen, guys, I'm about ready to lament over you and this whole and all of Jerusalem because of what's going to happen to you because you've missed the appointed time of my coming. If only," he says in his prayer there while he's weeping tears for them, "that you would have known that this is the day that would have brought you peace." But they're missing it, right? And he's trying to tell them, look at, it's almost, there's a little bit of a mockery here, as it were, because he's saying, look at, if these people aren't yelling, I'm telling you, the very stones would cry out. And we think, oh, that's poetic. You know, it's a metaphor. Is it really? Because he's saying, if you're not going to acknowledge this event from 4,000 years ago, that's all throughout your scripture, all the prophecies that are lining up for this event, and you're missing it. He goes, I'm telling you, creation itself will cry out to you. Because this is a big story happening right in front of you. And you get a hint in the Old Testament, both in Isaiah and the Psalms, where this king comes back and his ruling power reaches its potential. Isaiah writes a lot about it. The Psalms add some things about it. And it's kind of poetic and mystery. But listen, in Isaiah, who wrote 6 centuries before this, he goes, "The mountains and the hills will burst into song before the Lord." If you want to know if stones can shout, he says, on that day when creation is released from the curse of sin, he goes, "The mountains and the hills will burst into song before the Lord, and all the trees of the field will clap their hands." Now you kind of know where in The Lord of the Rings Tolkien got the idea of talking trees, right? Because he was a believer. And then in Psalm 96, "The trees of the wood will sing to joy before the Lord, for he comes to rule the earth." Let me tell you, if the trees and the rocks are going to clap and dance and sing under his ruling power, what's going to happen to you and I? And that gets us to the second point. What can this king do? Clearly, if he has the power to get trees to clap, he can do some extraordinary things for you and I. And there's another little hint of what I'm talking about here, of what he can do. And it's in this narrative here, in verse 30, when he says, "Go to the village ahead of you, and as you enter it, you're going to find a colt tied there, which no one has ever ridden." By the way, I have this harmony of the gospel. So when I read Luke, I'm looking at Matthew, and I'm looking at Mark, and I'm looking at John simultaneously at the same event at the same time. What's going on, right? And all four gospels weigh in on this event. In Matthew, you get a little more description of what's going on. Jesus says in the Matthew gospel account, "Go into the village over there. As soon as you enter it, you will see a donkey tied there with its colt beside it. Untie them and bring them to me." Interesting, huh? And when you read the Matthew account, it says they put cloaks on both of them, but we know from the full gospel account's readings that he got on the smaller of the two. And they walked in. Now, this event, this little donkey's colt, as it were, that Jesus sits on, is the fulfillment of something also written 6 centuries earlier in Zechariah's book of the Old Testament. "Rejoice, O people of Zion, shout in triumph, O people of Jerusalem, look," here it is, "your king is coming to you." Do you think, did any of the Pharisees, did any of the ruling leaders, did any of the scribes see this at that moment? Perhaps some did. Perhaps some thought it was contrived. But here's Zechariah writing. He is righteous and victorious, yet he is humble and riding on a donkey, riding, actually, he says, on a donkey's colt. Now, we're going to get back to that in a minute. But let me just ask you a quick question. And I never thought about this until this week, and I picked this up in my reading. What happens if you jump on an animal that's never been ridden before? They ain't going to dig it, are they? You got to be a bit of a cowboy to do that, even, I think, on a donkey's colt, right? Because when you hop on, does that little colt say, "Hey, where to?" But not only do you see Jesus gets up on this colt that never has been ridden before, he rides it through this loud crowd. I've heard different estimations on the size of the crowd, you know, from several thousand to literally over a million people were lining the road when he comes in. And the reason for that was because of the rising of Lazarus from the dead shortly before his entry into Jerusalem. In fact, John chapter 11 and John chapter 12 talks about that. But this one commentator writes, in the midst of this excited crowd, this unbroken animal remains calm under the guidance of the one who has also calmed the sea. Thus, the events points to the peace of what his completed kingdom will be and what it will look like, which took me right to this passage in Isaiah, who talks about that day when the kingdom is in place, when Christ rules. In that day, he says, the wolf and the lamb will live together. The leopard will lie down with the baby goat. The calf and the yearling will be safe with the lion. We're all like going, cool, right? Here's what's going on, and it's important. Right back in the beginning, which we were looking at Genesis, Adam was made to name the animals, and they were made for humankind. But we were to be their stewards, as their friends and managers, if you will. We were to mesh in harmony and take care of them and use them for the pleasure of the glory of God, right? George Whitefield, he's an old Anglican preacher from the 18th century, used to say, do you know when you get near animals, why they bark at you and growl at you and scream at you and then run away? Because animals intuitively, instinctively know that you have a quarrel with their master. Interesting, huh? But Jesus gets up on this little donkey colt, and what happens? He doesn't need to break it. In fact, whatever it is he's doing, he's healing it of his fear of humans in that moment. I mean, this little donkey colt is fearless in the face of a screaming crowd. And you don't see Jesus whipping it and holding a bridle on it and pulling it, you know, and somebody holding it down while they're walking with him. No, he walks calmly with him. He's healed this rift between humankind and animals, right? Where he didn't need to break it to get it to submit to him. And I want to say to you, there's this place in Romans chapter 8, one of my favorite chapters in the Bible, where Paul writes, if God is for me, who can be against you? Who can be against me? See, the gospel comes into our life and says, ultimately, to you and I this morning, what in the world are you afraid of? To the degree that you have Jesus in the center of your life, to that degree, you should be free from the fear of death, free from the fear of failure and criticism, even sickness and even loneliness. Jesus says, this is what is in me that I give to you to heal you, to transform you, to change you. This is what my kingdom looks like. This is what my kingship looks like in your life, just like what it did for this donkey. This colt is no longer afraid of anything. He's a picture of what? Peace and calm. And God says, this is how I will work in your life as a king, if you let me in. This is what I can do for you. And so when Jesus Christ, he comes into your life, and we see these passages, and he what? He demands supremacy, right? He says, I'm preeminent over you. I am what? Your king. And he therefore does what? He commands us, right? And in commanding us, he's calling on us to what? Follow him. Let's use the word that America doesn't like anymore. Obey. Right? Our mantra is now what? Question authority, right? Christ comes in and says, don't question mine, because I'm here to heal you. Follow me, he says. But in America, we go, oh, that's terrible. Jesus wants to come into my life and force me into his box, right? But Christ doesn't work like that. It's our fault partially, I think, because we seem to demand and force his worldview on those who don't accept it at times. But I want you to understand his perspective here is his rule over your life is the same power that he had over that colt. He heals us from what ails us. He doesn't put us under his thumb. That isn't his approach in any way, shape, or form, is it? Becky Pippert, who wrote a famous book called Out of the Salt Shaker and Into the World, said, Jesus is the only one in the universe who can control you without destroying you. What does that mean? Well, we've preached this so many times here. Stop and realize, and I know you've heard me say this many, many, many times, we all choose to live for something, right? Whatever you make preeminent and supreme in your life, whatever you're chasing, as it were, whatever drives you passionately that you spend your time and treasure on it in order to obtain it, whatever you're doing that for, whatever you're living for, will, to the degree that you give yourself over to it, will control you, right? It does. There's something in life that's controlling us. You know, the Harley riders that have the little license plate on the back that says, live to ride, right? That's my life. I live to ride. But what happens to mechanical things? They break. And when they break, they're controlling you in that moment, aren't they? Because, well, I live to ride, but my ride ain't riding, man. I know. Jesus is the only king who rules you by fixing us, by fixing you. That's the promise of his kingdom. So on the bad days in this life, I need to ask this question to myself. If under the lordship of Jesus Christ, the trees and the stones will be singing and dancing, what will I be like? The waters are stilled. The unbroken colt is relaxed. What will his kingdom and kingship do for you? Because he is the true king. That's the who question. And he answers that he's also the only king that changes everything. Everything, including you. Now, third point, why does Jesus do all this? Well, when you look at the story, you see that he chooses deliberately to what? To ride in as a public spectacle into Jerusalem. Do you notice when you see Jesus' story, many times he hides or he goes away, right? In the storyline, in the gospel. But here he's deliberately and outwardly what? In fact, let me take you back to a quick story in Nazareth when he goes and preaches in the temple early in his public ministry when he first comes out and begins his mission work, right? He declares that he is the fulfillment of that great passage in Isaiah that I've come to heal the brokenhearted and raise them up. And they all knew it was a messianic passage. He says, today this has come true in your hearing. And they so freaked out that he declared himself to be that Messiah that they wanted to throw him over a cliff. And as they brought him to the cliff's edge, all of a sudden, where'd he go? You know? They're wrestling with no one. He left their midst, right? And so here he deliberately chooses to ride in. He's now a public spectacle. And let me just tell you, when kings rode into cities, they rode in for one of three things. Their coronation, their victory over battle, or the fact that they are about ready to conquer who they were riding in on their horse, you know, their majestic stallion. So when Jesus says to the disciples, I'm going to ride in, I'm assuming that some of those disciples at that moment were thinking, finally, finally, we get to knock some heads. Our man has the power, and we're gonna show off here, right? But then Jesus says to them, well, you're going to find an animal no one has ever ridden before. And by the way, it's not a donkey, it's the foal of a donkey, it's the colt of a donkey. And this is the upside down Jesus right here. Trust me, the disciples got to be thinking, what is he doing? He just raised Lazarus from the dead. We've got hundreds of thousands of people out here, and he wants to come in on the foal of a donkey? Somebody get to Jesus. Tell him he needs a new PR manager, right? Because the imagery here is notable. If he were coming to conquer either the Romans or the Jewish religious hierarchy, then he would have been riding a war horse, right? But he doesn't. He comes on this donkey's colt because he has a different mission. And this is so important as we lead up to ultimately the crucifixion and his resurrection. What God's plan, divine plan throughout history is he's coming to save the world from sin and death itself. A 4,000-year-old prophecy about to unfold, and it's unfolding in the most unlikely of ways in the mindset of the people that thought the Messiah would be on a stallion, right? John MacArthur, great pastor, says, it is clear that Jesus is always in control of the events that affected his life. So important for you to understand this. Every detail of his life was controlled. Only his omniscience, his all-knowingness, could have allowed him to know that the donkey and her colt would have been where they were waiting to be found, right? You never think about, well, yeah, how did he know that? Duh! How does he raise people from the dead? How does he heal the blind, the mute, the sick, the lame? He's God. He's the creator of the universe. And here he is in a humble form, right? And he goes, John goes on, he says, it seems totally inappropriate that any king, much less the King of Kings, should make his triumphal entry mounted on a donkey's colt rather than a beautiful stallion. But this is what God's prophet predicted, and this is what God's son did. Now, he didn't do it because the prophet predicted it. The prophet predicted it because this is what God was going to do, period, right? Because this was the divine plan. This is what the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit in eternity past had determined how they were going to deal with their greatest angel that when they created him, they knew he would fall one day, and then he would create another creation, humans, and he knew they would fall. God knew this whole story. This is not like a, oh gosh, shucks, look what happened. What are we going to do about this? This is so cosmic, so ancient, so huge. And here we sit at Sierra Community Church in 2019, and we're unlayering this again for everyone to understand the magnificence and the glory and the awesomeness and the power and the might of God and how he works and how he chooses to work. That's what we're looking at. So why this way? Because by choosing a little colt, talks about the fact that his kingship is not the kind of kingship they were expecting, and it's certainly not the kind of kingship we expect of the creator of the universe, right? He takes the humble ride, right? Who of us, if given the option of a muscle car, is going to pick a Chevy Vega, right? And if you don't know what a Chevy Vega is, it's time to get older. He takes the humble ride because in God's divine plan, he is the suffering servant. This is the way God was going to deal with our fall. It's a picture of his weakness in the midst of a reality that he could have overpowered everything, right? It's like you know you have all the ability to win the game, right? You can make every shot, but you don't. And the other team thinks, we're killing them, right? And he chooses willfully to lay it down. So everything in his life is done with this meaningful intent, including this humble coronation. Then what does he do? Because this is where you see his strength here, what I call his fearlessness. This is the paradox of Jesus, weak but strong. And even in his weakness, he's amazingly strong, right? Because he chooses to be weak when he could be strong. But here he is now coming out, open in the public, and he enters the temple area and he begins to drive out those who were selling. And he screams at them, my house will be a house of prayer, but you've made it a den of robbers. You defiled it. He calls them out, right? For the second time in his ministry. He did it in the first Passover 3 years earlier. But he throws out the sellers. And what are they sellers of? They were both money exchangers to get the temple money, so they took a little cut right off the top to get the temple money. That's what made them robbers, right? Well, you got to buy this with Disney dollars. I'm sorry. And you have to pay $1.25 for one Disney dollar of your money, right? And then you take your Disney dollars and you walk over, and now you buy the animal that's going to be sacrificed because of your sin on the Passover, right? Based on what your economic status was. He's throwing out the sellers of the animals for the sacrifices. And look at carefully what he does next. He was teaching in the temple every day. And yet, he was doing this in light of what truth? That they were looking for a way to hang him up. And he did it anyway. And I love how Tim Keller, he just opened my eyes with this week. I never saw this before. He, Jesus, throws out the old way of meeting God, which was what? Animal sacrifice, right? He gets rid of that on the first day. And then he teaches them smack in the middle of the temple. Why? Because he's demonstrating that he is the real temple. Remember when he said, tear this temple down and I'll rebuild it in 3 days? He's giving this word picture to him. He's the ultimate priest who makes you acceptable to God. He's the ultimate sacrifice that puts away your sin. He's demonstrating this right here in the midst of this moment. That's why the author of Hebrews would later write this most insightful passage. Jesus did not enter heaven to offer himself over and over like all the animal sacrifices did on earth, right? If that had been necessary, Christ would have had to die again over and over and over ever since the world began. But now, once for all, he has appeared at the end of the age to remove sin by his own death as a sacrifice. The great prophecy of Genesis 3:15 is the suffering servant comes to take care of the problem we created. He's paradoxical in his nature. He's strong and yet he's weak. Sin is you and I putting ourselves in the place of the rightful king. That's what sin is. No, I want to be king of my life, right? Salvation is the rightful king putting himself in the place of sinners, taking the penalty for us, strong by being weak. He's a king, all right. But he's a king not coming just to throw out the Romans or to save his people in some political or religious way. He is here to answer the cosmic question from 4,000 years earlier of sin and rebellion that has infected all of mankind and will for at least another 2,000 years after his death and resurrection, right? He's still saving us, isn't he? So how does he make this happen? The last point. Who? He's the actual king. What? He changes everything. That's what he is. Why? He's the paradoxical king because he switches places with those that he saves. Henceforth, the humble donkey ride. The picture of that, right? And how does he do this? Well, as I just mentioned, by both being strong and weak at the same time. And his strength is everywhere in this storyline, okay? You know, when the religious leader said, rebuke your disciples. He's forcing their hand, isn't he? He's not messing around. Even though he's coming in on a humble donkey, they are crying something that no man is supposed to receive unless they are the Messiah. And of course, no one believed that. They didn't care how many Lazarus he raised from the dead. Let me show you how hard-hearted they were in light of his miracles. They said, this is in John, if we allow him to go on like this, soon everyone will believe in him. And their fear was not that they would, well, lying if they did, their fear wasn't we'll lose power and prestige. You bet that was a big part of that story for them, that they were going to lose their power and prestige. Even more so, then the Roman army will come and destroy both our temple and our nation. Isn't it interesting? That's what happens anyway. So from that time on, John says, the Jewish leaders began to plot his death. He must be taken out. He's too great a threat to our nation, right? And that's why every day they're looking for ways to kill him. So when he got up on that little colt and rolled in, people shouted about his kingship, and he's making a claim so big, there are only, understand this, so important to us today, practically speaking, two possible responses to Jesus that day in the mindset of the people. You either crown me king, or you must kill me. He refuses to sneak into the city, because now his time has come. And that's why he says in John chapter 12, my soul is now troubled. Why is it troubled? I know it's coming. But what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour? No, it was for this very reason. This time of weakness and humility that I, the suffering servant, unto death, that reason that I've come to this point in my life. And there will be nothing about me that will be sheepish or shy. And unlike earlier confrontations where it was in his time, like on that hillside in Nazareth, Jesus over and over, and John says, my time has not yet come. Later on in John 7, they tried to arrest him, but no one laid a hand on him because his time had not yet come. These are all miraculous moments. He was later at the Feast of Tabernacles. He was not arrested because his time had not yet come. Well, now is his time that's come. And we see just how bold he becomes. He's saying, crown me or kill me. And yes, I know, neither you nor Rome will crown me. But those that will, here's the thing. He's saying to you and I this morning as well, I will not accept anything lukewarm. I will not accept anything in the middle. I will not accept people who just want to like me. I don't want you to think of me as somebody that you speak nicely of. Don't drag your sorry butts into church because you want 2 ounces of Jesus, is what he's saying. You bow to me. And that's why he says in John 12, verses like this, anyone who loves their life will lose it, while anyone who hates their life in this world will keep it for eternal life. He's saying, this world is dying, my friends. Do not align yourself with it and then try to give me lip service, right? Patronize me. Oh, yeah, he's the King of Kings. But you don't mean it. Because he says, whoever serves me must follow me. Because why? I'm the king. And where I am, my servant will be. If they're my servant, that's where they'll be. And my Father will honor those who serve me. So choose ye today who you will serve. Joshua wrote in the Old Testament, as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. Either you make me the absolute center of your life, the absolute authority of your life, or completely reject me. But do not insult me with this lukewarm attitude about who I am. You need to position your mind where I am. It starts there. Ah, he is the king. He is the one who can save me. I am the sinner and I am lost. He is my only hope. That is a position you take in your mind. It doesn't mean your life is going to live out that reality in total perfection. No, it's not. It's a process called sanctification. You're going to grow in that understanding. But you start by putting your mind there. And Jesus says, I won't come into your life, nor will I come into Jerusalem as anything other than your king. Are you hearing me? He will not come into your life if you take only 2 pounds of him. You're kidding yourself. He's saying, I can be your helper, you bet. I can be your healer, your counselor, your friend, even your brother, but not first without being your king. There is no middle ground. All of me or none of me. I'm either your king or I'm your enemy. So, for Christ to be king in your life, it begins with this acknowledgement that we preach every week at the end of our message, the grace of God. Lord, you accept me because of what you've done for me, not because I could have done anything myself. But the mind position is what? You are the one that does this, not me. You are my king because you are the one that does this. And how I live is the process of what the mind knows is true, first and foremost, that he is that king. So ask yourself that question. Is he my king this morning? Is he really, truly at the throne of my heart? Because if he is, you will constantly live with the tension of those poor choices. I do. Every day. Every week when I go, I'm not treating you as king. Now, is he still my king? Absolutely. Will he not forsake me? Absolutely will not forsake me. Why? Because I've come to him in faith and trusted him. And now I'm working out the consequence of that trust, and I feel that tension all the time. Oh, I'm not living his way. Will he reject me because I'm not living his way? Absolutely not. Does that make sense? But he's king. And that's why this passage, which we slam up here all the time for you, is where we lock in our mind that God made Jesus, who never sinned, to be the offering for our sin so that we could be made right with God through Christ. Who's doing it? God through Christ, your faith. If you can't quote that, remember 2 Corinthians 5:20 and look at it often. Jesus is the only one who could have taken your sin from you, and when you see that, you gladly make him your king, and therefore you worship the reality of who he is. What he does changes everything. Why he does it? Because he switched places with you and I. And how he does it? By being strong but weak at the same time. Because that's how he conquers this world. Strength to endure anything, my friends. The humility to be used the way he was used is the message of salvation to a world. We try to speak to a world in strength. With strength, they won't listen. It's just this. We speak to the world in weakness as Christ did. People take notice. Why are they humble? Why are they gracious? Why are they aren't sweating bullets in the midst of their cancer diagnosis or in the loss of their loved one? What is different about them? Because we're following Jesus' way to the cross. But one day, the Lion of Judah will return. The Lion. That king. And his Father will honor those who have served him in faith and humility. Let's pray. Father, I am not overstating it to say that I am profoundly affected this morning by the reality of who you are in your Son Christ and what you have done. And today I feel more committed to follow you than I think any day in my life previously. And my prayer is, Father, that each of us today that call you by name would be motivated by that great reality of who you are and what you've done. Such a great love for us. Such an amazing gift given to us. May we take that with the seriousness that it calls us to. I pray this in your name, humbly, Lord Jesus. Amen.